Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Please take care of yourself.
Welcome to Fruit Loops, episode 199.
199? Oh my God.
That's so close to 200.
I know.
Bwiti binafi, bwiti achiluruni, and bienvenidos, bitches. And thank you for being here with us. We are so thankful. Now, Fruit Loops, in case you're new here, is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and those who are othered and the victims. Because contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cisgender, able-bodied white dudes.
What?
No, girl, these crimes rarely get any public attention, and that's because the news is racist, allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman, and I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white.
Look, she's one of the good ones, y'all. That's all I have to say.
We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions.
All right, so who are we talking about today, Beth?
Well, today we're talking about Dwayne Lee Harris, a man who killed three women in Seattle, Washington, between 1997 and 1998.
All right. Well, before we get into the Dwayne of
the Dwayne of it all,
how you doing?
I'm doing good. So we were on break.
That's right.
I got some rest, and my daughter and her family moved back to Arizona. So yay. I've been able to spend a lot of time with my grandson, and it's been great.
So wonderful, hip hop air horns to family. Well, that's good. So did you guys have a nice, like, 4th of July and all that stuff?
Yeah, we didn't really do anything for 4th of July. Well, I took my grandson to, not on 4th of July, but I took him to a wave pool, and he
hell
just
yeah.
loved it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then on 4th of July, I didn't really do anything. So
yeah.
I'm not a big fan of 4th of July. It's too
like
hot here.
I was like, put your black fist up in the air because, you know, black people just, it's more of like a family reunion.
Right.
It's day everybody
barbecue.
Has
yeah.
yeah. We're not like, woo, 1776, am I
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You know? So, because at the time the Declaration of Independence from England was signed, I think 50 something white guys signed it.
Right.
Guess how many of them owned slaves?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
40. What?
I would have guessed all of them.
Yeah. Don't fact check me on that stat, but it was a lot of them. So
yeah.
anyway,
yeah.
but happy to be back from the break. It was chef's kiss. We had Juneteenth in there. My birthday was in there. Father's Day. I love this time of the year. I mean, June is my favorite month because of all those things. Yeah. And then Essence Fest kicks off. I've never been to Essence Fest, but it's on my vision board. And just the photos from Instagram make it look like so much fun. And then that's how you know summer is here. Plus, a whole bunch of summer movies. We got the windows open, the breeze. Oh, I love it. Love
it. Yeah, it's too hot to enjoy it here.
Yeah, I forgot that it is so hot. You could die
if you're
outside too long. But yeah, I mean, even if the summer is too hot, you know, up north in Canada and the northeast part of the United States, there was some wildfire shenanigans.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it can be treacherous to be outside, but a break is nice nonetheless. So I'm happy to be back and happy to hear my wonderful friend Beth and her voice and her wisdom. I can hear it all brewing.
And Wendy. And Wendy, too.
Oh, yeah.
I missed your shenanigans.
You did? Uh-oh. You're going to regret saying that. All right, let's get into some listener letters.
Well, hello, angels. We missed you.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
Hi. Well, forgot what I say here. What's in the bag, Beth?
Well, we got a big old bag because we got a lot of letters over the break.
Sack.
Yeah. Big fat sack. I wanted to say thank you to Shelley, the Primal Collective, Jillian, Garrett, Nancy, Lindsay, and Tammy for your emails and thoughtful questions and comments. And thank you to Monica for your Instagram message.
Yes, thank you all so much.
And then also Jane Doe to you, Jessel P, Ribka 1, Autumn and Nibsy, and Sevchuk for your 5-star reviews.
Yes, thank you all so much. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, the bag was full and plentiful over the break. It was
very nice.
Yeah, it just reminded us so much of why we do the show.
Why we do this. Yeah.
Just love and appreciate all of our fruities so much. So thank you.
And please send any questions or comments to FruitLoopsPod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294. And we may feature it on a future episode. Also, join us on Patreon, where we have literally hundreds of hours of bonus content. And we have a video club for 12-plus patrons where you can interact with us in person.
Okay, so we also got some new Patreons, new patrons, and a Ko-fi donation. So when you support the show via Ko-fi, Patreon, or Cash App, I make a personal tune for you as a sign of gratitude. Plus, you get some bonus content sometimes.
Yeah.
So I want to say thank you to Jessica D and Garrett with a hard G and Danny P. Here's a hip hop air horn for all of you before I forget. All right, here goes. Thank you, Jessica, for your Patreon. We were on a break. Now we are here. Thank you, Jessica. Hope you love this show. This tune is for you. You alone.
Aww.
Okay, Garrett, this is for you. Also, Garrett, as Beth said, thank you for your wonderful email and your handsome Ko-fi donation.
Yeah.
All the way from the Netherlands. Woo. So here's for Garrett. We love that Garrett now. Them chickens jacking my style. Them messy hoes got no swagger. We on that next shit now. G-So 3008. Ho-So 2000 and late. We got that Garrett boom. That future Garrett boom. Let me get it now. Boom, boom, boom. Garrett, that's for you. Thank you. And then Danny P, this is for you.
You really don't remember. Was it something Wendy said? You got podcasts in your head. Calling Danny P. Danny P. I think they got your number. Danny P. I think they got the alias. Danny P. That you've been living under. Danny P.
Anyway, thank you all very much
thank you.
Supporting our show. I had too much fun doing that, but it's because I really appreciate y'all. So if you're new here, before we get into our episode, we would like to say that this is a podcast about true crime, people of color, and those that are minoritized. And true crime is difficult to talk or hear about sometimes. Race can be too, but difficult things are just part of the world that we live in, and we cannot fix anything if we don't face it. So we want this to be a safe space where we can have difficult, sometimes imperfect conversations about all the things. We're all learning all the time. Sometimes we make mistakes, but we just cop to it, learn from it, and keep it moving on our collective quest to be our bestest, sexiest selves. Amen.
Yeah. And we welcome our listeners to be part of the conversation on Facebook or Twitter or Threads.
Whoa. Yeah, that's right. We are in Threads.
We're
forgot.
In Threads now. At Fruit Loops Pod, or email us at fruitloopspod@gmail.com.
All right, let's take a quick break and get into the story when we come back.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So
nice.
I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering.
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp.com/fruit.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939 when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era like Cuba and Vietnam. And I'll unpack the conspiracy theories, too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.
We're back! Remind us, Beth, who is our subject today?
Today we're talking about Dwayne Lee Harris, a.k.a. the Seattle Shoelace Slasher, who killed three women in Seattle between September 1997 and February 1998.
All right, let's get into some stats. So as Beth said, Dwayne Lee Harris had many AKAs, the Seattle Shoelace Slasher, the Seattle Jungle Killer, Chili Willy, after a cartoon about a penguin. And when I said Jungle Killer, more
yeah,
racism.
That's what I
just great. That's what I thought, yeah. But it has to
the,
do with
the place.
The physical setting of the area. And then his signature apparently was removing victims' shoelaces and then using them to tie the women up after they were dead. The three women were murdered in similar ways. Two were found bound with shoelaces and two were strangled. One woman's throat was slashed. So this next segment is our love and light section, where we want to offer love and light to the victims. There were three victims in this case. Rest in power to those three women whose names that we know of. Denise Marie Harris, 42, Antoinette Jones, 33, and Olivia Smith, 25. So again, rest in power, queens, and also love and light to the communities, family members, friends, loved ones left in the wake of this terrible case. So let's get into the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Well, the setting is the city of Seattle in King County, Washington. Seattle is a seaport city located on Puget Sound in the Pacific Northwest. It lies on a narrow strip of land between the salt waters of Puget Sound and the fresh waters of Lake Washington. Beyond the waters lie two mountain ranges, the Olympics to the west and the Cascades to the east. A little over 100 miles to the north is Canada.
Whoa! Hey, Minnie! So the Puget Sound region has been inhabited by humans for at least 12,000 years. The land where Seattle sits is the traditional territory of Coast Salish peoples, specifically the Suquamish and Duwamish tribes.
Captain George Vancouver came to the area in 1792 and named the Inland Sea for his second lieutenant, Peter Puget. Vancouver's reports on the region's economic possibilities and natural beauty unfortunately encouraged further British exploration.
Which is a euphemism for theft, pillaging, rape, imperialism, all the bad things.
Yeah.
But the city of Seattle was named after Chief Seattle, who was a Suquamish and Duwamish chief. The town, interestingly, took the name of this Native American person, but engaged in the practice of excluding Native people, Black people, Jewish people, and Asian people in the city ordinances and housing covenants, which are still on the books to this day.
They're still on the books? Oh my God.
Many of them, yes.
Gross.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seattle was incorporated in 1869. At the time, the population was only a little over 1,000. In its early years, Seattle's economy was dominated by logging. The city grew slowly until the arrival of an interstate railroad line in 1893, which then led to rapid growth.
So the waterfront served as the main supply depot for the Klondike. What would you do for a Klondike bar? They're disgusting. Anyway.
Oh, I like them.
I think that people who mix mint and chocolate should go to jail.
Well, they're not
and
all mint.
And you know
mint.
What?
They're not all mint, though. They're like chocolate and vanilla.
I've never had one that wasn't mint.
Really?
That's a game changer. Yeah, all the ones I got were mint, and I was so angry and offended.
Yeah, how I think some of them
you?
Even have caramel in them.
What?
Yeah.
I've never seen a Klondike bar with, and okay, this, we're going to have to talk about this later, friend, because I had no idea. I had a whole rant prepared for Klondike bars, and I've been wrong this whole time. Whoops.
You just need to get a non-mint one.
I do. Well, I was going to like send everybody to jail for Klondike bars if I was the boss of things. But now that doesn't have to happen. So anyway, the waterfront served as the main supply depot for the Klondike gold rush of the 1890s. And it quickly emerged as one of North America's leading seaports with more than 50 miles of wharves. Sea wharves.
You know.
Yes. Weird word.
But this period was marred by anti-Chinese riots. And we've talked about this before, up and down the Pacific coast.
Yeah.
A wave of racially inspired violence hit the entire West Coast following the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Mm-hmm. The first and only major U.S. law ever implemented to prevent all members of a specific national group from immigrating to the United States.
Yeah. I mean, 1882, in my mind, really isn't that long ago,
it's
right?
Not.
It's a few great grandparents away.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh, that's ancient history. Get over it. Well, we can't get over it because
it's really
still
not that long
to
ago.
This day,
yeah.
And it wasn't that long ago, right?
Yeah.
So by 1910, Seattle's population had reached nearly 250,000. The depression of the 1930s hit Seattle particularly hard. But when the U.S. joined World War II, Seattle emerged as a center for the production of war materials.
The city experienced a pronounced period of expansion, and many people migrated there from other parts of the country for jobs. The city's ethnic mix changed markedly during this time. By the late 1930s, Chinatown was reestablished in Seattle as a distinct neighborhood.
However, relations with Asian people in the city again soared after the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor by the Empire of Japan. In 1942, almost all of Seattle's Japanese-American community, then numbering more than 6,000, were deported to a detention camp in Idaho, and their property was seized. And actually, when I was in junior high in Washington, we had a survivor of the Japanese internment camps in Washington come and speak to our class.
Wow.
And I remember, like, what?
Yeah.
This person is still alive? Like, it's just, and again,
wild.
There's still people alive who experienced this horror.
Yeah, the guy from Star Trek.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. What's his name? George?
Takei.
Takei.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah.
He is really a gem on Twitter, but.
He is.
Hopefully he'll go to Threads so we can follow him.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is not ancient history.
No. At the same time, Black Americans began arriving in large numbers, drawn to the area by the promise of wartime work. However, until 1968, it was legal to discriminate against minorities in Seattle when renting apartments or selling real estate. It was legal.
Mm-hmm.
And there was widespread employment discrimination against Black people and ethnic segregation in housing and public services.
Yeah. And one of the resources I turned to research for this case was a podcast by realtors in the Seattle area.
Oh, wow.
Who were, you know, they did this episode after the racial reckoning, quote unquote, we had in 2020. And they were relearning their own city's history. And that's when I discovered from their reporting that some of these covenants, the discrimination on paper is still on the books in some places. And you can check, you can look for your title and file an amendment if your property has language like this. But it's so insidious and a lot of people don't think about it, right?
Yeah.
So that's why a lot of them are still there. So by 1960, Seattle's population exceeded 500,000. Wow, what a jump. The city embarked on an ambitious federally funded program of urban renewal, which is a euphemism for, I've heard some people say, Negro removal, or the removal of Black people and Indigenous people and people of color, through which large sections of the downtown area were reconstructed, with tall skyscrapers replacing sprawling warehouses and residential areas.
The rapid growth of the knowledge and high technology sectors in the 1980s and 90s encouraged migration into the area from all parts of the world. And by the late 1990s, about 2 million people lived in the city and its nearby suburbs.
Yeah, but guess what? It's not all good.
What?
On a per capita, you're not going to believe this. On a per capita basis, and a lot of this migration, especially in Washington, happened after the government started forcing schools to integrate. So there was a lot of white flight in Seattle and other places in Washington. But as I said, it's not all good. On a per capita basis, Seattle and King County are among the top three regions in the country for homelessness. And on a year-to-year basis, the number of people experiencing unstable housing or homelessness has been growing.
In the Seattle area, homelessness is in large part driven by the growth and wealth creation in the region. Over the past decade, the King County region has enjoyed robust economic growth and is home to two large companies, Microsoft and Amazon.
Hey, our county's so great, Bill Gates lives here. Between 2010 and 2020, the population in King County increased by 12%, but the county increased its housing by only 8%.
Wow.
That's not going to work.
Nope.
This gap has led to large increases in rents across the board, as much as 52%.
Wow.
Yeah, it's insane, the prices. Yeah. Additionally, over 40% of the lower cost units were demolished to make way for more expensive ones.
Jeez.
Dumb idea.
Yeah. And surprise, surprise, homelessness tends to be higher in densely populated cities with expensive housing.
Mm.
Gee,
yeah.
I wonder why.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The housing market in Seattle is off the hook.
Mm.
The discrepancy between home prices and median salary can cause people to become homeless because they can't pay rent or buy a home.
Yeah, and I think it would surprise people to know that many people experiencing homelessness are gainfully employed,
yeah,
but just don't make enough money to cover the cost of living.
Right.
And, you know, it's also difficult to maintain employment when you don't have a place to bathe, prepare meals, or electricity to set an alarm, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The stigma of homelessness creates difficulties for those looking for work. They don't have a permanent mailing address, which is often required on a job application.
Mm-hmm.
They might not have transportation to reliably get to work. And some have disabilities.
Right. And then we can't forget about our LGBTQ brethren and sistren and fam who, if they're sometimes can't find employment or housing because of their transness, right, or their queerness.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who are affected by insufficient housing and access to it. And there are many myths about homelessness that are simply not true. It is common for people and politicians to lay the blame for homelessness on individual failures and personal weaknesses, which is bullshit.
Yeah.
People point to alcohol and drug abuse or poor choices.
There's a whole ass documentary titled Seattle is Dying, which conflates homelessness with drug use, mental illness, and crime. This documentary was produced by KOMO, owned by the Sinclair Broadcast Group.
Oh, no, not going to see it. Thumbs down.
And the Sinclair Broadcast Group is well known for featuring news content and programming that promotes conservative political positions.
But the fact is that the majority of people experiencing homelessness in Seattle are not addicts. And although some are, very few people cite substance abuse as a root cause of their homelessness. Some acquire an addiction after becoming homeless because, as you might imagine, becoming homeless is extremely traumatic.
Yeah, I can't even imagine.
I can't either, but I wanted to shout out a page on Instagram. It's called Invisible People, at Invisible People. And they just go around the country interviewing people experiencing homelessness and asking them to tell their stories. And most of them, it's just this.
Yeah.
You know, something bad happened, a medical bill, a divorce, something happened that made money really tight and they just couldn't swing it anymore.
Couldn't.
And now,
yeah.
And that could happen
to anybody.
I'm one paycheck away, disaster away from shit going real south. And I think that's a lot of people.
A lot of people, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There is a myth that providing services to people experiencing homelessness only attracts more of them. Free-addle is a common term used by people in Seattle who subscribe to this myth to describe the homelessness situation there, meaning that unhoused people are flocking to the region for the overabundance of free services.
But surveys have consistently shown that the majority of the unhoused people in Seattle were living in Seattle or King County when they lost their housing. Of the small percentage of people coming from other places, most of them came to Seattle for jobs that didn't pan out. And they were not people already experiencing homelessness who suddenly decided that Seattle, ooh, it's going to be so fun to go to Seattle. That's not how it works.
No.
What?
Another myth is that people experiencing homelessness are service resistant, meaning that they do not want to accept shelter or services. But one man experiencing homelessness who was interviewed for an article said, quote, "Homeless people aren't service resistant. Homeless services are people resistant," unquote. I thought that was a great quote.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
In fact, there are many obstacles to accessing homeless services, such as lack of transportation or required documents like IDs, social security numbers, you know, those kinds of things, social security cards. The homeless assistance and housing system is also under-resourced. It's fragmented and it's difficult to navigate. And a lot of that, I think, is on purpose.
Yeah, I think so, too. Many shelters and housing programs have stringent eligibility criteria and rules. Some of these are strict curfews, required chapel or class attendance, mandatory program participation, and forced labor participation. Usually, no pets are allowed. Some shelters don't allow personal belongings, and others don't allow families.
Yeah. Another myth is that a lot of people experiencing homelessness are criminals and inherently dangerous. The fact is that homelessness itself is criminalized. Unhoused people often receive citations for minor offenses. Well, how am I going to pay this citation?
Yeah.
Is somebody going to give me a ride to the courthouse? It's ridiculous. And other things such as unauthorized removal of a shopping cart, jaywalking, loitering, panhandling, and other low-level crimes. And these are also crimes, by the way. These are black codes that turned into poor people codes.
Oh, wow.
So...
yeah.
There's that. Thanks, America. Just kidding.
Thanks, America.
Fourth of July.
Oh, boy. Therefore, the unhoused make up a disproportionate number of arrests by police, and they are overrepresented in and adversely impacted by the criminal justice system. They are often in and out of jails for low-level crimes without rehabilitation for their mental illness or trauma.
This just exacerbates the ongoing issues of homelessness and poverty. People who have been incarcerated are more likely than the general public to experience homelessness. And without access to mental health resources and care, it's much harder to get people housed, employed, and stable.
It's a vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But research shows that providing access to housing first
without forcing residents to participate in specific services, has proven to be successful in keeping people housed and allowing them to more easily work towards addressing mental illness, substance abuse, or other health issues.
Right, because if you fix housing first, everything else has an opportunity to get fixed and get the help that you need. But a lot of these models are so ass backwards.
They don't want to do it. They just don't want to do it.
Yeah, there has to be, I think, a desire for, you have to reimagine things, right? You can't just keep incarcerating people who are poor and expecting the problem to get fixed.
No, it's not getting fixed, and it hasn't been getting fixed.
Yeah, exactly. The problem.
Come on. We need to do something different.
Yeah. And I know that there are some housing first models throughout the country. Yeah. And, people like to point to their failure rates, but I think their success rates are admirable. And if we just keep implementing and housing first solutions in communities that are willing to give it a try, I mean, see what could happen, right?
I mean, if you can change, just a few people's lives, it's worth it to me.
And we bail out, businesses that are doing
trillions
poorly,
of dollars.
Right?
Yeah.
Bazillions. Yeah. What about bailing out people who are down on their luck?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Just a thought.
Just a thought. What do I know? I'm just a podcaster. Anyway, the vast majority of people experiencing homelessness, include those with mental illnesses, aren't hurting anyone. People living on the streets are far more likely to be victims of violent crime themselves than they are to commit such crimes, especially if they're a woman, a teen, or a child.
Having a home to live in brings safety. Living on the streets puts people at risk of crime and violence, including murder, assault, rape, and theft. People experiencing homelessness are also often the victims of hate crimes. And we've covered at least one serial killer who targeted people experiencing homelessness, and there's more of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we've covered quite a few cases that were in the news.
Yeah.
With people targeting people experiencing homelessness. And I don't know what came of those cases, which is probably why we haven't done episodes on those ones.
Yeah.
But yeah, it happens.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
We are gathered here today to give you permission to plan the wedding that you want.
I'm Jessica Bishop.
And I'm Sari Wienerman.
And we're the hosts of the Bouquet Toss podcast.
Today's couples have to juggle so many things, from family expectations to outdated traditions and what's currently trending.
So to make it easier, we're going deep to figure out why we do weddings the way that we do, so you can decide what to keep and what to toss from your wedding day plans.
You are cordially invited to subscribe to the Bouquet Toss wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcast.com.
By the power vested in us, we pronounce you free to plan your day your way.
So now let's get into the early life of Dwayne Lee Harris. What do you got, Beth?
Well, Dwayne Lee Harris was born in 1963 in St. Louis, Missouri. According to Dwayne, he was raised in Boston, Massachusetts, then moved to Washington State. He said he grew up in a strict family and his mother would beat him when he got into trouble.
And I'm thinking of the new listeners. So if you're new here, just a quick culture corner. It is not, especially at that time, this is the early 60s when he was born. So he would have been a child in the late 60s and a preteen in the early 70s. And it was not unusual for Black parents to engage in corporal punishment, spanking, beating, to correct their children, because the price of a Black child doing something wrong in public could mean their life. And yeah. That's still true to this day. But I was listening to a podcast today about child abuse, and it was two Black pontificators. And the woman who studies child abuse said that the whitest thing you could do is beat your child. because that was what they did in Europe back in the day, and they brought all those traditions over, and not slave masters, hostage takers and human traffickers, aka slave owners, implemented that kind of discipline, and the practice was carried on. So anyway, I'll shut up about that one. Anyway, Harris said that he was an angry child who was always pissed off. When asked if it was because his mother beat him, he agreed and said that he wasn't close to his mother and that he was closer to his father.
Yeah, I have to say this is all coming from Harris himself. So
right.
We don't know the veracity of all this, but this is what he said. Mm-hmm. He said that he started stealing at the age of 6 and joined the Santana Block Crips in Boston at the age of 12. He was required to put in work to join the gang, meaning that he had to commit crimes to get in. And he admitted to committing many burglaries.
Reportedly, Harris was arrested multiple times for theft, burglary, and rape. Harris claims that he is responsible for other murders as well, and that he killed people when he was with the Santana Block Crips. So now we're going to dive into the timeline splish splash, Beth.
In Seattle, an underdeveloped plot of land underneath and along an elevated section of the I-5 and I-90 freeways is known by locals as the jungle. It's a green belt on Beacon Hill where people experiencing homelessness often camp. The jungle was described by retired police detective and media personality Joe Kenda as a gathering place for lost souls ignored by society.
Joe Kenda, not familiar with that guy.
You don't know Joe Kenda?
No, girl. Is he? What is?
The homicide hunter. It's an old white cop.
Okay, Joe Kenda. All right. Homicide hunter. Wait a minute. I think I met him at Crime Con.
Did you?
Maybe not. Maybe he's dead. I don't know.
Maybe he's dead.
I'm getting all my white guys confused. Anyway, where were we? The jungle consists of 150 acres underneath and along an elevated section of Interstate 5. It's an urban forest with thick blackberry brambles and vines growing among maple and other trees. This sounds like a romance novel. okay. At one point, there was an estimate of more than 400 people in the area living in campsites. But it sounds really pretty.
Yeah, it does.
The way it's described.
Actually,
brambles and vines growing among maple and other trees.
Yeah. I actually went on Google Maps and dragged that little person down there to look at the what do you call it?
Street view?
Yes, I dragged it down to street view so I could look at it.
Oh, did it look? I mean, blackberry
brambles.
It
looks really pretty around there, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on September 12th, 1997, the body of 42-year-old Denise Marie Harris, who's no relation to Dwayne Harris, was found in the jungle. Denise was a college-educated preschool teacher battling substance abuse issues. She'd lost her job, and her boyfriend, James Cooper, last saw her when they'd fought and she'd left. Reportedly, she met Harris in downtown Seattle.
Denise had been strangled to death with a belt. Her shoes were missing their laces, and a belt was wrapped around her neck. Her hands and ankles were bound with her shoelaces, but not tightly. The killer had also stuffed a bra in her mouth.
So the shoelaces were not used to tie her up and then he killed her. They were put on her afterwards and not tightly. It's like his thing. He liked doing that. Don't really know why. Yeah.
The signature. But right. I mean, this guy.
This guy. All right. Yeah.
Right over here. He sucks.
Investigators found a beer can impaled on the branch of a tree near the body. Her purse was missing and she had no identification, so at first they didn't know who she was. Her clothing was new and she was not dressed in layers, so investigators surmised that she probably wasn't living in the jungle.
Denise was eventually identified by her fingerprints. Everyone investigators spoke with had nice things to say about her, including her boyfriend, who hadn't seen her in a week. He was eventually eliminated as a suspect.
On February 1st, 1998, the skeletal remains of 33-year-old Antoinette Tony Jones were found behind a business, half a mile east from where Denise was found. Medical examiners determined that she'd been dead for at least 3 months.
According to her mother, Tony struggled after her brother, who had served in the first Iraq War and suffered from PTSD, unalived himself. She fell on hard times and spiraled into depression and drug addiction. Oh, also, I was listening to a podcast about suicide. And what the mental health professional was suggesting is when we are talking about language around unaliving oneself, that instead of saying somebody committed suicide, because that makes it sound like the person did something bad,
right,
that they completed suicide.
I've heard that unalived. Before. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, completed suicide.
I thought that was
good to
useful
know.
Information if,
yeah.
if we're talking about this stuff. So
yeah,
sorry to remember for any triggers, but yeah, I have to remember that too.
Okay. Like Denise, Tony's wrists and ankles had been tied with shoelaces, with an additional one wrapped around her neck. She was dressed in layers of clothing, indicating to investigators that she lived on the streets. A tote bag was found near her body containing papers with her name on them.
On February 1st, 1998, an unhoused man looking for a place to sleep found the body of Olivia Smith, 25, a Native American woman, curled up at the bottom of an outdoor stairwell outside of a business, less than half a mile from where Denise's body had been found. He called for help and the authorities arrived at the crime scene.
Unlike the other two victims, Olivia had been stabbed repeatedly and she then bled to death. She'd been stabbed in the chest, 7 times in the buttocks, and her throat was slashed. The way she was dressed, with layered clothing, indicated to investigators that she lived on the streets.
However, one of her shoes was off and untied. Police found this odd because it was the middle of winter and very cold, and there was no reason for her shoe to be removed.
There was no knife at the crime scene, and she had no identification. Olivia was eventually identified by her fingerprints. The man who found her was investigated. He had blood on his clothing, but he told investigators that he'd been in a fight and it wasn't the woman's blood. DNA testing confirmed this, and he was eventually eliminated as a suspect.
Olivia was in a relationship with a man who was abusive, and she filed a protection order against him after he'd threatened to stab and kill her. So he became the prime suspect, but he was also eventually eliminated.
The detective investigating Olivia's murder, Cloyd Steiger, remembered the murder of Denise Harris and the involvement of shoelaces. He theorized that the killer was interrupted when he'd killed Olivia, which is why her shoe had been removed and untied. His MO had been interrupted and the shoelaces were not used to tie the body up.
Detective Steiger talked to Mike Szczynski, the detective handling Denise's case, and the two of them believed that the murders of all three women, Denise, Tony, and Olivia, were connected. So now, let's get into the investigation and the arrest. Hit it, Beth!
In early 1998, Harris was jailed on an unrelated robbery charge. Then in April of that same year, Harris called a detective out of the blue and claimed to have information about the death of Denise Harris. He offered to lead officers to the real murderer.
So he knew details about the murder of Denise Harris and claimed that he had been with the guy who did it. He wanted a deal. And police kept him talking.
Detective Mike Szczynski, who Harris called Mikey Mike, and Detective Cloyd Steiger would pick Harris up at jail each day, take him for a hot dog and a cappuccino, and then have him lead them to different places.
Doesn't this sound irritating to you? Like he just wanted some sort of attention?
Yeah.
And I mean, I'll do anything for a hot dog. I love hot dogs.
I mean, I'm sure he was bored and he probably wanted a deal.
Yeah.
So he thought, you know, if he blamed somebody else for this murder, then he would get out of jail. And then they took him for hot dogs and cappuccinos. And he's like, yeah, this is awesome.
Field trips. Yeah, this is great. The only reason why I went to school was for the field trips. And this sounds like something like that. So he took the detectives exactly to the place where Denise had been killed and described the beer can that was impaled on the tree branch by her body. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
He said that he knew where her purse was and then led them to it.
So even in articles in newspapers about this story, a lot of them say that he was with an accomplice when he killed her. But there was no accomplice. He
did. I don't think so either.
Yeah.
I don't think so either.
So, yeah.
He also took them to places where the killer was supposedly hiding, such as a bar where the killer supposedly liked to hang out. Then after several days of this, Harris finally said, quote, "Mikey Mike, I'm tired of this. Yeah, I killed her. And I killed the one down in the stairwell, too," unquote.
Whoa. So Harris told police that he fantasized about murder and he did it because, quote, "I just get a thrill for killings," unquote. He said he confessed to the police because he wanted people to know what he had done.
Harris claimed to have been killing his, quote unquote, whole life. When asked why he killed, he said, quote, "because I could and I wanted to," unquote. He said it was his hobby.
What? His hobby?
His hobby.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Of all the hobbies.
Hobbies, yeah.
Wow.
Take up woodworking or something.
What, sir? Read a book. Or, I mean, did you hear about, let me go to the setting again. Did you hear about the bumbling blackberry brambles and vines growing around maple and other trees? You could have sat there and read a book
and it had some blackberries. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Everybody loves blackberries in Washington. It's a thing. Anyway, so according to Harris, he and Olivia Smith were friends. He hadn't planned on killing her, but did when she pulled a knife after a confrontation with him over drugs.
In the meantime, police found a woman who had survived an attack that was stopped by an unhoused man, and she identified Harris as her attacker.
And on May 20th, 1998, Harris was charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder and was placed in the King County Jail on a $5 million bail.
$5 million, wow.
$5 million, wow. So he's never getting out.
Yeah, no.
I want to take a moment to tell you about my podcast, Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage. In 1984, a woman named Phyllis Cottle was abducted in broad daylight, tortured, and left to die in a burning car in Akron, Ohio. At the time, I was a rookie reporter covering this horrific story. Since then, I've reported every kind of crime imaginable. I've been able to leave most of them at work, but not this one, the one that buried itself under my skin and stayed put. Phyllis Cottle was a badass woman, and I want to tell you her story. A production of Evergreen Podcasts and signature title of the Killer Podcast Network, you can find Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage wherever you get your podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcast.com.
So let's get into the trial. What the what, Beth?
During his trial, Harris shouted obscenities at the judge and jury, pushed chairs, threw objects, and argued continually with the prosecutor. His behavior during the trial was so bad that they had to strap him to a restraining chair. I have never heard of that before.
It's pretty wild. Now, I will say that the idea of decorum and decency, those are white male colonial standards, right? That we sort of all have, it's a box that we all have to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
However, this is extra.
Wow. Yeah.
This is not like him just being himself. This is so beyond, it's outrageous behavior, right? I can't even think of the word. It's just, it's out there.
It's more outrageous than outrageous.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the most outrageous thing ever. Although he had already confessed to killing all 3 women during the trial, Harris recanted saying that he had killed only one of the victims, Olivia Smith. Harris testified during the trial, quote, "I just snapped. I cannot lie. I snapped. I did kill her. That's the God's truth. I don't have to lie about killing Olivia Smith," unquote.
Prosecutors described Harris as a manipulative predator who preyed on vulnerable women and said that he only confessed for the sake of his ego, as, quote, "he wanted Seattle to recognize there was a serial killer," unquote.
Well, after 3 days of deliberations, the jury found Harris guilty of first-degree murder in the deaths of Denise Marie Harris, Tony Jones, and Olivia Smith. Dressed in jail clothes, he refused to change. Harris threw his head back and laughed when the verdict was read.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Before he was sentenced, Harris told King County Superior Court Judge Marsha Petchman, quote, "Everywhere it's going to be chaos. It's more of us killers," unquote, adding that his imprisonment would not keep her and others safe in their homes and apartments.
What? What? His, man, Harris said that justice for the victims and their families could not be served no matter how much prison time he received because he was still alive and still had certain privileges, even in prison. Quote, "I'll still be walking around the prison yard. I still got radios, TV. I'm still going to kick it," unquote.
Okay. This guy is not the sharpest wow. tool in the shed.
I don't even know. Like, oh my, I hate him so much.
I know.
Wow.
The judge told Harris, quote, "I have never run into anyone who has shown the kind of lack of reverence for human life," unquote. Mm. As he was escorted out of the courtroom, he cursed and swore at the jury. Oh my God, this guy.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, a big thing about trial, I've been to many trials. A big thing is whether or not the jury likes you,
yeah.
right? Like, you could, in theory, be totally guilty. But if the jury likes you and thinks you're credible, you
could
might
get away
not
with it.
Be found
yeah.
guilty. Yeah, exactly. And boy, oh boy.
Yeah, not this guy.
Not this guy. So now we're going to get into where are they now? Well, I'll tell you. Harris, good riddance, is currently being housed in the Stafford Creek Correction Center, located in Aberdeen, Washington.
In an interview, Harris implied that he could have committed at least 32 other murders, saying, quote, "For three bodies, you might get 32 more," unquote. I think he's just full of shit.
Blowing smoke. Yeah. He's got a lot of smoke, a lot of stories.
Yes, yes, he does.
And who knows what's what. But what do you think of this case, Beth? Tell us what you think made him snap and your thoughts.
Well, Harris described himself as an angry child, saying he was pissed off all the time. Whatever caused his anger, I don't think he ever dealt with it. It was just living mm-hmm. inside of him. And mm-hmm. eventually mm-hmm. it came out in the form of murder. That's what happens mm-hmm. when, well, not for everybody, but for
right.
some
there's
people.
A lot of angry people who don't
murder
anybody.
No, but it comes yeah. out in weird ways, you know? If you have sure. anger yeah. just festering inside of you, it's going to come out.
Yeah.
In some way or yeah. another, for most people, it just mm-hmm. comes out in weird ways. Blowing up at people or, you know, just acting yeah. like an asshole. Most people don't murder, mm-hmm. but this guy murdered.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were a lot of reasons for his anger to fester, including being abused as a child and racism. But again, as mm-hmm. always, it's an explanation, not an excuse. And this guy, mm-hmm. you know, he took it mm-hmm. to extremes.
He really did.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. this case was frustrating for me to research because I couldn't find a lot of information about the victims. And I would have liked
yeah.
to have told more about them.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. Like Olivia
I tried
was
really
an,
hard to get more information.
An indigenous
about
woman,
her.
Right? Yeah. yeah. And maybe because of the time of, you know, I don't know why, but I also wish that we had more information
yeah.
about the victims because I thought as we were reading their names, like, grandkids, future kids. Like there's so much that's happened since 1997 and 1998 that
yeah.
these women will never get to be a part
right.
of. And this motherfucker is still breathing,
yeah.
which is frustrating.
It is.
So
it also makes me really angry that he chose these victims, some of the most vulnerable people in our society, which is common
yeah.
for serial killers. But, you know, just talking about the homeless population and mm-hmm. just makes mm-hmm. me really mad.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. I couldn't agree with you more. We both listened to that interview with
yeah.
Harris, and we only know what he told us about
right.
his childhood. And he mentioned at one point during the interview that he was neurodivergent as a kid, and he just talked about taking Ritalin in the interview. And he was born in 1963 during the Civil Rights Movement, so his nursery school and junior high years would have been shaped by some big events in the United States,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You know, on top of the strict parenting, and the alleged beatings, we had the assassination of MLK, Malcolm X, Fred Hampton was killed, JFK was killed, the Vietnam War was going on. There was a lot of trauma and turmoil. The government was not trustworthy. And so, and then he also moved out of state several times. And then with his neurodivergence, that's a lot for
yeah.
a young kid. And if the message he might have received was the world hates you and the world is terrible and violent, it makes sense why he was so angry to me and why he was indifferent towards systems, like why he was cackling in the courtroom. Yeah. Like he didn't give a shit about the law or rules or anything like that. And he was also really indifferent towards human life. And, you know, he joined a gang. It seemed to me he might have found stability in being a part of a gang. And I think you're right. He never dealt with his anger. It just grew and grew and grew. And he described one of the murders with lots of details. And he talked about blacking out. And then all of a sudden, before he knew it, somebody was stabbed 40 times, right? And it's not an excuse. But to me, there are many explanations for his anger issues. And it's just unfortunate for everybody. Like right now, we know our kids are going to have a hard time in the future because of the trauma of the pandemic.
Right.
And I don't think in the 60s and 70s, people were like, what's a Vietnam War? And what are all these assassinations of leaders going to do to the generation who's watching grownups fuck shit up?
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And I don't know, maybe that's too woo-woo, but it's a thought I have. And also, again, love and light to the people who lost people they loved in this case and whose communities are missing members. So let's get into how not to get murdered. Well, just kidding. If you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
So I found an app created by Black people.
Oh.
And it's called Angel Tech. And Angel is spelled A-N-J-E-L.
Okay.
Tech. And I did find it on the Google App Store. Not sure about Apple because I'm a poor person. But it's a good idea. I thought it was a really great idea and something to think about. You know, if you decide to download this particular app or not, but what it does, there's other apps capable of doing. This just does it in one stop. It's like a personal security system for you and your family. It's handheld in your phone.
Okay.
So if you're in danger or someone close to you is in danger, you can open up the app and it will live stream, it will record, it will send the live stream to your friends and family members who you've designated as such on the app, and it will send your family members and friends your location. So it shares all of this in real time, efficiently and discreetly. And you might be like, well, why can't I just upload it to Facebook Live or Instagram Live? You could, but those apps own that footage.
Mm.
And I don't know if you guys know this, but when Black activists film fuckery by the state goes after those people who posted that to their social media profile. So this is a way to keep people even safer. So I thought it was a neat idea. There are obviously other apps. If you know of other safety apps, let us know. But this one's called Angel Tech. And I thought it was neat.
Yeah, so that is neat.
Just sharing it with the fruities.
That is neat, yeah.
Anything else?
No.
Okay, well, look at this. It's shout-out time when we shout-out any content by people of color or any minoritized folks or any true crime goodies.
Wendy just turned into a cartoon.
I did. Oh, get these helium balloons out of here. So this is from Lindsay, and it's called Our Fake History, a podcast about myths we think are history and history that might be hidden myths.
Hmm.
And you can check that out wherever you get your podcasts. And then Cheekbone Beauty is an indigenous-owned beauty brand. And they say that we promise to forge the path to true sustainability in line with the teachings in our indigenous roots, creating a perfect circular economy in the cosmetic space.
Nice.
This is fire.
Yeah, very cool.
So Cheekbone Beauty, what do you got?
I just wanted to shout out Blind Plea Podcast.
Okay.
So here's the synopsis.
Okay.
In 2017, Devon Gray, a young mother, shot and killed her abusive partner in rural Shelby County, Alabama. Mm-hmm. She claimed self-defense and filed a stand your ground claim, but she was offered a blind plea, an option to take an unknown sentence in exchange for pleading guilty.
Hmm.
As a Black woman who shot and killed a white man in Alabama, she took the plea.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And is she on death row?
I'm not gonna
this
say.
Sounds, This sounds very bad. I need spoilers now. So just as a recap, shout out to Lindsay for giving us this shout out. The podcast is called Our Fake History, wherever you get a podcast from. And Cheekbone Beauty, which is an indigenous-owned beauty brand at cheekbonebeauty.com. It will be in the description box. And the Blind Plea podcast, which gives me anxiety just thinking about it. and that's wherever you get your podcasts. Oh, no.
We're at the end. Yes.
That's the end of the show. Yep. Gosh darn it. All right. Well, Beth, where can the people find us?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use fruitloopspod for all of our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show and become a Fruit Loops patron. You can also support us by supporting our sponsors or by giving us a 5-star review.
5 stars only, please.
Also, don't forget to subscribe, which helps us a lot.
That's right. So this is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
I missed your shenanigans.
You did? Uh-oh. You're going to regret saying that. All right. Oh, what the fuck? Shut up, Wendy. Hang on a second.
Shut up.
Sorry. Beth?
I got confused.
What would you do for a Klondike bar? I'll do anything for a hot dog. I love hot dogs. So... yeah. There's that. Thanks, America. Just kidding.
Thanks, America.
Welcome to the jungle. So, sorry. The jungle consists of, I'm sorry. The jungle consists. I'm sorry. Oh, my God. Okay. Serious. Okay.
Let me start over.
What do you... Whoops. Burp. Is that it? Nope, that's not it.
Magic
No, that's not it. I was like, what is Gloria doing? Why is she running away? Why does she have an alias and a secret number? Gloria, what's going on? To Mike Sisniski. Mike Sisniski.
Dwayne.
Well, this has been so much fun.
Well, I was gonna send everybody to jail for Klondike bars if I was the boss of things, but now that doesn't have to happen. So, anyway, the waterfront.
A detective came and knocked on the door. And I said, is it Renee? And he just gave me that solemn look.
It was the worst day ever.
The Proof Podcast is back with a new case and a new season. 23 years ago, 18-year-old Renee Ramos went missing. Her body was later found in an empty Home Depot building on the edge of town.
I don't think that they arrested the right people. It's about time somebody's trying to do something.
She had a black eye about 2 weeks before she was murdered.
They are involved. They definitely had her body and her backpack.
You know people are going to judge you, right?
Of course. They're judging me now. They've been judging me damn near my whole life.
You can listen now to season 2 of Proof, wherever you get your podcasts, and follow along with us as we reinvestigate the murder at the warehouse.
I have to ask, did you kill Renee?
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast, Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an Evergreen podcast, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.